This episode of the UAV Digest is sponsored by GoEngineer, provider of design, engineering, and 3D printing solutions for the aerospace and unmanned vehicles industries. To learn more, visit the UAVDigest.com/GoEngineer. You're listening to episode 234 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm David Vanderhoof, just back from Baltimore, Maryland, in Fort Washington. Hey, Max.
Hey, David.
I think I'm losing my voice, so I'm going to apologize in advance that I may sound like a frog all of a sudden.
Oh, what a great way to start. Well, you were just at an exciting event. The FAA and the Association for Unmanned Vehicle Systems International, AUVSI, co-sponsored FAA's third annual Unmanned Aircraft Systems Symposium, as you say, in Baltimore. That was just a few days ago, March 6th through 8th.
Yeah, as we record this, I came home early this morning and then did a full day of work to come home and do some prep for the show, and now we're recording. It was a really good show, well attended. Overall, some of the symposiums, they eventually had to move up to the ballroom because they weren't fitting. There weren't enough people fitting into the conference rooms they had set up for it. So we should probably get started and have a conversation and talk about a lot of things that I've learned that I didn't know about regulations in the FAA and all sorts of things like that. So let's get started. Well, on Tuesday morning, I drove down to Baltimore, Maryland, to the Baltimore Convention Center, to attend the Federal Aviation and the Association for Unmanned Vehicle Systems third annual Unmanned Aircraft Systems Symposium. I didn't stay all 3 days, but I did do 2 full days. And let me tell you, it was intense and full of work. And I learned a lot, and it was very, very crowded. 2 major themes before we go into some of the stories about it. Data. The FAA doesn't have enough data to do rulemaking. They were begging, pleading for people to send in data so they could continue making rulemaking. The other part was not the formal announcement, but I guess a soft announcement of remote ID for everybody. I did quickly say an apology to Lee Elliman last week. I had a discussion with her about hobbyists who are flying model airplanes do not need remote ID. But after some of the lectures and conversations I heard, I think my opinion changed on that.
Hmm.
But we'll get into that further. Starting off with, this is from DroneLife.com, FAA Symposium, drones seeing massive adoption, safety concerns are now a primary issue, which is where this remote ID comes in. They are concerned that the airspace between zero height to 400 feet is going to get really crowded, and Homeland Security and other departments are concerned about anonymous people.
So when we hear the term being used, remote ID, David, what that means is that a drone flying is broadcasting something or presenting some kind of identifier so that others can determine who is flying the drone or who owns the drone being flown?
Exactly. And the technology isn't necessarily has to be on the drone. Right now, they're looking for a solution where it doesn't matter. You need to be broadcasting something. Now, that could be your ground station. It also could be, if you think about it, it could be an area. one of the scenarios was what happens with an air show. And an air show means that, you know, you file for all of the documentation and you say that on this date you're going to have this box, and you provide all of that documentation up front. And what that documentation does is it sets up for the FAA a NOTAM. And this is the kind of thing they'd like to do for drone racing, for the drone racing leagues to provide all of that information up front, because the FAA understands that a racing drone doesn't need additional information broadcasting out of it, nor do any of the drone racers want to add additional weight. So there are broad definitions on this remote ID, but it's basically they want to know who you are and what you're doing. And the other analogy that came out of this was in the next 10 years, there's going to be a lot of aircraft flying at 400 feet. And the general public are going to suddenly be more aware of these aircraft flying around. Now, identifying them means that you have the added advantage of you can figure out the three C's. Now, I've tried to figure out how to describe the three C's until this show, and this was what my biggest thing that I came back with was. You have the clueless, the careless, and the criminals. I liked that a lot. That pretty much sums up all of the categories. The clueless means they don't know what they're doing. The careless means they do, but they made a mistake. And then the criminals, of course, are the ones who are purposely flying aircraft with bad intent. With remote ID, you can correct the careless, educate the clueless, and arrest the criminals. I heard that and I went, okay, I think I'm okay with this whole remote ID stuff. If you have remote ID and you're flying legally and you're doing everything what you're supposed to, the government, when they get a phone call saying this person's flying their drone over my house, with remote ID, you can say, oh, well, that person's doing a survey of the house next door and they're not really flying. They're flying correctly and it's not a criminal act. So I think remote ID is going to be more positive going forward.
We'll have a number of articles that we run across on this topic in the show notes, but across them, there were some interesting quotes from different people on this topic. One of them is from Angela Stubblefield. She's the FAA's Deputy Associate Administrator for Security and Hazardous Material Safety. And Angela said, anonymous operations in the system aren't consistent with moving forward with integration and expansion of operations. And then going further, Brendan Schulman, who's currently Vice President of Policy and Legal Affairs at DJI, said, the FAA is not going to create future rules for expanded operation of drones until the remote identification framework is in place. So, David, what I'm gathering here is that if we want to be able to fly over people safely, if we want to be able to fly beyond visual line of sight safely, then it seems like the consensus, at least as expressed at the conference, is that we need this remote identification as kind of a precursor to allowing these other capabilities. Am I reading that correctly?
It is. And a lot of this stems from UTM, the Unmanned Traffic Management System. They need to know who you are. A big emphasis was 400 feet or lower, which I didn't realize, but most radar air traffic control radar systems don't go that low, except in final approaches for airports. So we have to develop an unmanned traffic system that will manage the huge volume of aircraft that'll be flying in the 0 to 400 airspace. And you're going to need to be able to ID these aircraft, especially if ones are going beyond visual line of sight. If you want to do package delivery and you want to, and somebody, and one of them goes haywire, you want to know who that aircraft is and who it belongs to. So like Shulman said, the FAA has come to this realization and needs to move and wants to move forward with it. Now, nothing has been standardized yet, but clearly remote ID was a big deal at this symposium. It was probably the most crowded seminar was the remote ID seminar. And it was standing room only and hot, and yours truly got started to feel a little bit dizzy standing up against the wall because he got in a little late. But there were a lot of people intently listening on what they have decided is going to be what's going to happen going forward.
The issue, of course, is to which drones, which classes of unmanned aircraft does this or would this apply? And I would have, I think, taken a position a little bit opposed maybe to requiring hobbyist recreational users to comply with this kind of a thing. But what does the Academy of Model Aeronautics have to say about this? Have we got any feedback from them?
It didn't come up. I have a feeling that they will give pushback, but I really don't think, given the current environment, they're really going to have much say. As a big supporter of the AMA, I'm kind of disappointed, but they are going to be in the minority for use of this airspace. If they want to use the 0 to 400 airspace to fly their unmanned aerial vehicles, otherwise known as model airplanes, they're going to need registration. And I mean, the only other way to do it would be if they lock down to radio controlled flying fields. That would fall into that we're going to have a meet, you know, we are going to have a meeting and a fly out, and it's going to be in this airspace at this time. These are the things we're going to do, and they're going to pre-file it before that event happens. So they don't need aircraft with some sort of remote ID. And remote ID is twofold. It is labeling the aircraft as well as the aircraft sending some sort of signal.
I still think there must be some threshold for requiring that. I mean, you're not going to take a $25 or $99 drone, I think, and impose this kind of requirement on that. I mean, it seems kind of burdensome, and I don't know if it's entirely necessary, but I guess we'll see. Did you get any sense for the urgency to move forward with this? Any ideas on how soon we might see some absolute proposals?
Probably by the end of the year. Okay. They are moving quickly on this. The answer to your question is that it goes back to the whole data thing. They're trying to make rules with very limited data, and the game is consistently changing. It's a very fast-moving change in products and capabilities and sensors, etc. And those factors are causing it to be hard to make rulemaking. And one of the things that came out of the rulemaking was they are doing exemptions and trying to simplify the rulemaking. But in order to do that, we need more data, and that then the rules will facilitate speeding up the processes. And the FAA wants to continue to grow a dialogue between the industries, the pilots, everybody working together so they can move forward. It's not an adversarial practice, but more a complementary working together, you know, flowing information back and forth so that this stuff can move forward. Because right now we've sort of moved away from the adversarial, but there is a nascent adversarial thing is that industry and everybody wants to move quicker, faster. And the FAA isn't able to keep up because they don't have the data to do the rulemaking, and they don't have the necessary people and technology to do that. So there was a bit of a tone of adversarial, but the FAA is saying, we're doing everything we can and we want to work with you. It's not us against you. We're all in this together.
Mm. Well, that makes sense. And that's, a good healthy way to look at it. You know, David, rulemaking is a slow-moving, complex process for good reasons. But like you say, when the technology is changing, when the desire of users to undertake new kinds of missions as the capabilities unfold, that represents kind of a moving target. And it's difficult enough to make rules, but when the landscape is changing, I guess you could say, as quickly as it is, that makes it even harder. When the FAA says that they need data, I can understand where they're coming from.
And to dovetail off of that conversation and a parallel conversation is, I sat in on the discussion on standardization, and both RCTA and the American National Standards, ANSI, the American National Standards Institute, were both in there. And both organizations are working on drone standardization. But again, they were desperately pleading for data, because you can't focus on standards without data. And these organizations are all coming from an aviation background. And aviation's had so much time and so much lead time, and all of the things that they've learned over time, they can set standards up. Whereas with drones, you set a standard up and it might be obsolete before you even get the standard up. And then, of course, the FAA needs those standards to help rulemaking. So it's kind of we're in one vicious circle when it comes to this.
Now, I also see that there was an announcement on the low altitude authorization and notification capability. We're looking for an expansion into more airports.
April 30th, it starts. Lance was a conversation that permeated all of the other, like remote ID. And remote ID is partly because of this low altitude by Skyward. They are setting up these USS, which are unmanned system specialists, who will be doing the management of the UTM, or in this case, Lance, which is the trial. And they don't have enough data yet. And part of the identification process is anonymous doesn't work in when you're trying to move aircraft from one space to another. And it's from Lance, and was another thing where they've come up with the fact that we need remote ID. It was kind of interesting that there were certain themes that were permeating no matter what the conversation was about. And cooperation, collaboration, that was a big word. Data and lack of data, standards, rulemaking, all of those sort of flew together. Beyond visual line of sight, remote ID, they're all sort of working together. And what they're trying not to do is silo them, which is what they've been doing recently, which is, beyond visual line of sight is one set of standards, one set of rules. Remote ID will be one set of standards, one set of rules. But really, you need to start bringing them together. If you talk about unmanned traffic systems, are they operating beyond visual line of sight? Do they have remote data? All of these things sort of flow together and in and out from each other. And the silo kind of techniques that we've been using aren't necessarily working due to the volume. I mean, getting an exception to your 107 so you can fly a tower that's 1,000 feet tall, or in this case, the authorization would be 1,400 feet tall, there should be better ways to do that. Bridge inspection. When you're flying a bridge inspection, believe it or not, it could be a beyond visual line of sight function. Because if you're flying underneath the bridge and through it, you might not see the aircraft you're flying.
Sure.
Rail inspections, long straightaways where you're flying miles away. Now, it's one thing, flying it out like the they did the beta test out in the middle of nowhere for Burlington Northern Santa Fe. But what if you're doing rail inspection for a inner urban area? And this was another scenario they came up with. You're doing a rail inspection, and that rail inspection goes next to a very sensitive nuclear plant, power plant, some high-value target. If you're flying that mission, that's why you need remote ID, that they can go up and say, you know, okay, that drone is flying in that airspace. Who is it? Oh, it's BNSF flying their tracks. No problem. We don't need to focus on that. Whereas an anonymous aircraft, you have to find the aircraft, you have to find who's flying it, all of that, and that's time consuming. Remote ID is to not necessarily to be Big Brother, but just to know who you are and to be able to ignore you.
Hmm. Yeah, these things do kind of interrelate to a greater degree than maybe the way we've treated them in the past. But on Lance, we see that they're expanding to 500 airports, you mentioned, beginning April 30th. This, again, is a system that provides real-time airspace authorizations, and it uses the FAA-UAS data exchange. There's an interesting write-up at Skyward, and actually Tim Trott, the drone professor, sent a link to this to us, and 500 airports is, that's a lot of airports, and the rollout is phased by U.S. region, starting April 30th, running to September 13th, but this Skyward post lists all of the airports, and if you're interested in finding out, you know, when yours or when the airport near you may be impacted by Lance, you can find out there. And so we'll have a link to that in the show notes. Another issue that is in the press concerning Lance is that to this point, there have been four providers of that service: AirMap, Project Wing, Rockwell Collins, and Skyward. And I guess there's been a little bit of comment, a little bit of buzz out there that how come only these four companies are providing this service? Why not some others? So I understand another outcome in the last few days, David, is that the FAA is going to also consider service agreements with other companies. And they'll start doing that April 16th, and they're looking for applications by May 16th. So I think it makes sense to kind of open that up to, a broader set of service providers, especially as the volume increases here.
That was the intention, but you needed a small set to start the program as the pilot program.
Sure, yeah.
People were mistaking the pilot program for the bigger rollout. Now, needless to say, the people who participated in the pilot program are more qualified to be part of the rollout than somebody coming from scratch at the start of the rollout. So I don't understand why there were people who were complaining that there weren't enough people involved with the Lance program. It's going to get bigger. It's got to get bigger. And these even Skyward and everybody else was saying, we don't have the capacity to handle all of the volume. We're going to need more people. So they weren't, it wasn't like a monopoly saying, well, we did all this development stuff. They all know that they're going to have their share of the pie. It's kind of like FBOs. You know, you get different FBOs are run by different people at different airports. So this is another way to look at the industry, and the industry's really driving this. The FAA is just sort of sitting back and providing the necessary guidance for the industry. But for all intents and purposes, this is an industry-driven program with the guidance of the FAA, and they're the first to admit it, that they didn't have the manpower to do this. And this is the model that they would like to use for a lot of other programs where we talk about moving forward. The FAA giving guidance, but relying on collaboration in the industry to come up with the solutions, to provide the solutions for the FAA so they can approve them and both teams doing the heavy lifting at what they're best at, you know. Solutioning these things are definitely better off being done by industry than they are by the FAA and the federal government.
Well, David, how do you think the attendees felt when they left after the event? Do you think, were they satisfied, encouraged, frustrated? How do you think the attendees felt about this?
It was hard to get a tone for across the board. Now, I will tell you that of the seminars I sat in, the two that were the densest packed, waiting, standing room only, a tent with bated breath were the remote ID panel, as well as the beyond visual line of sight panel. And then to a lesser degree, Lance, beyond visual line of sight, clearly everybody wants to do and they want to do it yesterday. The remote ID, the tone was there was a lot of people who want it, but they want to do it right. And they're more concerned about how it's getting done and how it's going to affect them. What's the cost involved? And the FAA doesn't have that answer yet. They don't have the data for that to make those decisions. So yes, it was coming, but no concrete things. The FAA did comment that this one was a deeper tone overall with all of the, not necessarily adversarial, but there was more concrete, less pie in the sky, industries moving forward, the FAA sort of trailing behind, and that tone sort of permeated throughout all of it. The gun is primed and the starter is sitting there holding it and it hasn't gone off yet, you know. So there was a lot of progress, a lot of really good conversations, and I think the tone was right. It's going to be a little adversarial because the FAA has got to move on to get us the regulation so we can move forward. It really was a very, for me, it was very intense in a learning experience. I was sort of a bit overwhelmed by the intensity and these discussions. Felt a little out of my league when some of these detailed conversations occur, like standardization and regulation. But I think the FAA is right. They're trying to collaborate. They're not doing a top-down. The standards they want are standards that they can move forward and not necessarily are prescriptive standards. They don't want to say your DJI Phantom must have an 8-ounce ADS-B transponder on, right? But what does the job of that 8-ounce ADS-B transponder? Could it be the phone? Could it be those kind of standards instead of prescription top-down standards, but just standards that they can say, okay, well, a cell phone does this job. We can accept this job, this standard, so that 2 years from now, the cell phone will be latest, greatest, but it still will meet the requirements of that first standard, if that makes sense. Instead of saying your 8-ounce ADS-B, well, what happens later on when the ADS-B needs to be 10-ounce? Do you have to rewrite it then? They want those kind of standards, and they need the industry to work with them for that.
It almost feels like if you went back 2 years and looked at where we were then, maybe we didn't know what questions we should be asking. And now, 2 years later, we're much better prepared to be asking the right questions. And maybe 2 years from now, those will be answered and we'll be sort of at the state that we wished we were 2 years ago.
Remote ID was basically the FAA admitted that, you know, they didn't realize when we started this that when we did registration, it was kind of a nice to do kind of thing. but they didn't really emphasize it. With all of this technology that's coming on, it's clearly pointing to we need some sort of registration system. You can't fly an airplane in the national airspace without it being registered. It doesn't necessarily, I mean, there are aircraft that don't have radios and don't have ADS-B and stuff, but they do fly over specific areas and you know to look for them, etc. You're talking about a management system between 0 and 400 feet, and you don't want to overwhelm the people who are doing the 400 feet and to thousands of angels, 12,000 feet, who are doing the air traffic control for everybody else. So there's, you know, anybody flying above 400 feet is going to be part of the national airspace, the normal air traffic control system. This is something we're talking about between 0 and 400 feet where most UAVs want to fly to get their best results. So all of those things is we're starting to learn to, like you said, to ask the right questions. But the more data we get, the better questions we'll be able to ask.
All right. Fascinating. Next time, David, it's my turn to go, I guess. I think this is a great experience. A lot of interesting, useful information coming out of this. Really pleased to see the progress. Thanks for your observations. But I guess we should wrap it up, unless there are any other kind of closing thoughts on the event, David.
I will say this. It's a really cool industry. I'm glad that we're part of it. In a small way, but did have people come up and say, I listened to you and the FAA was really accommodating and we're going to work closer with them going forward as well as AUVSI. It was, I have to admit, a bit overwhelming. I'm not an engineer. I'm not a lawyer, but the intensity was palatable, but in a good way. You can tell that everybody wants to fly right. They want to fly safe. They want to do what's right. And they want to push the envelope. And in the next 5 years, I think it'll be, we'll have come so far. And drone delivery's coming. I now believe it. You know, flying beyond visual line of sight. But we used to talk about that being not palatable. But, you know, it's coming. And the FAA wants to push it. You know, the president's initial pilot program for UAVs is driving a lot of this. Hmm. The White House has given authorization to overcome these challenges no matter how they need to do it. So they're able to leverage people like NASA and Department of Transportation and the FAA and all of these alphabet groups outside of the government to leverage this. So it was very optimistic, and I'm really glad I had the opportunity. And if you get a chance, go, because you can learn a lot. My brain still swimming in all sorts of data, but I really enjoyed myself and looking forward to going next year, maybe with my co-host.
Fantastic. All right, well, with that, you've been listening to episode 234 of the UAV Digest. You can find us at theuavdigest.com. And if you'd like to go straight to the show notes for this episode, well, then just go to theuavdigest.com/234. David, where can folks find us online?
They can find us on our Twitter account. And if you're curious about some of the things discussed, I would say go to our Twitter account at UAV Digest and go back and read through some of the quotes and I was live tweeting some of the seminars. You'll get to get a good feel of what was going on. Likewise, check out the FAA news Twitter feed as well as AUVSI at AUVSI. They all we were all tweeting at the time. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/UAV Digest. You can become part of our Slack listener team by sending us an email to feedback@theuavdigest.com. Send us some reviews on Stitcher, Google Play or Apple Podcasts. And of course, you can purchase some swag at our Cafe Press store. So with that, I'm going to say this is David in Fort Washington, who really needs to go to bed.
And Max in Hartford.
Thank you for listening.